You're listening to Breadbox Media. Find out more at breadboxmedia.com.
You're listening to Dr. Michelle Live. Dr. Michelle is a Catholic psychiatrist. However, the views and opinions presented by Dr. Michelle will advise. Please consult your doctor for official medical guidance.
Welcome. I am Dr. Michelle. You are listening to Dr. Michelle Live and my dog Mozart barking in the background as a leaf blower goes by. So I hope you're having a wonderful morning. I know I am. It's a beautiful morning. God is good. We have to praise Him in all things, all things. Father Pat, the Irish, very, very Irish person, a priest who was there with me when I first came back into the church in 2003, had a grandmother or maybe great, probably grandmother in Ireland in a little tiny fishing town that was no stranger to disaster. Always, always, no matter what happened, she would look up at the sky and say, "Welcome, be the will of God." So I will try to be like Saint Teresa today, a little flower who supposedly had this knack with taking all things that irritated her and somehow making them beautiful. So you can all pray right now and help me do that with the leaf blower outside. So I have asked the general people out here to please, during this time, let's make it quiet, because this is where I do the program from this little area here. And sometimes they decide that that's exactly the time they need to run machinery for at least 1 hour. And then it starts at my hour, 9 o'clock Pacific time or 12 o'clock Eastern time. And it goes until 10 o'clock and then it just stops. It's like, why can't we do that? Why can't we do that all the time? All right. So speaking of leaf blowers and all things mechanical, we're going to talk about nature today and the power of nature and why it really is God's medicine and why Job 12:7 is the way it is supposed to go. Job 12:7. You know, I'm going to read that to you. I keep referring to it all the time as my favorite one, because many of you, I've read it so many times that that many of you already know it, but I keep referring to it, and I suppose it's probably good for me to just go ahead and talk about it. But I'll do that on the other side of the break. First, I do want to talk a little bit about Robert J. Wicks and why I like him. I want to talk to you and probably go through this book, Riding the Dragon. Been thinking about that because I certainly don't want to just read. At the same time, this is a really good book, and it really, I love it for you and I love it for me for the exact same reasons. Only perhaps mirror images. One, Robert J. Wicks is a PhD. He works with trauma, first responders, people, the traumatized of the traumatized. He works with people who themselves have gone through trauma, and then he also works with people who take care of those who have had trauma. So I find him not only a very credible source, he also, and you know, people, as that one person told me that one time, people of the spirit recognize each other. You kind of recognize when people get it, when they really have an empathy for those who have suffered and are suffering, especially the ethereal things of the mind, the things that aren't so obvious, that are difficult to describe. And I'll tell you, it is a cool drink of water when somebody takes your 500,000 words to describe one thing and they just distill it down, whew, into a little drop, and they feed it back to you in a small little sentence. And you're just relieved. And I know that in my own life, for things that have happened to me, things that I've endured, tragedies that I've had to face, where when I'm trying to describe to somebody how I'm feeling, or even why I'm reacting a certain way, or why I may not be able to get the word I need at that moment because I'm so overwhelmed. And instead of the person appearing to me like I'm looking, mirroring back that I'm just a complete crazed person, they may, and they have done it many times. And when I say they, very many, very different people in different venues will just take a little, take three or four words and say, it sounds like, and then they say it. Sounds like you're very overwhelmed without being heard, or that you're feeling helpless and you don't know which way to turn. And you just go, yeah. And you just, everything lets down and you just want to weep. It's a phenomena. It's a human phenomena. Went through a little bit of that yesterday, probably a little bit intense. How we take our life around us and we keep stuffing it in these little sacks, our little mental sack. So we have just irritation and day after day of trying to get your relationship back on track in your marriage, not knowing what's going wrong, but feeling something's going wrong, and then getting irritable and knowing that's just going to inflame things, but you can't help it because the situation's so bad. And then it's like a chain reaction, a nuclear chain reaction. Once the match is lit or the atom is split in one direction, everything just blows up. And then you have other things you have to deal with, bills, and you're late, and someone's angry, and you know, your kids are just misbehaving, or you get that call from school that they never showed up, and one thing after another, and you get that, why do you think that somewhere along the line, when camels used to be an everyday part of life, the idea that the straw that broke the camel's back. At one point, everyone could relate to that because everyone understood how much a camel could take. And there's one tiny little millimeter, one tiny little minuscule fraction of an ounce that was just one too many. And you know how you, that little cliche, you know, just one too many. I just had one too many things happen in my day. And then you just, that's it. You just can't quote, what? Hold it in again. You can't hold it in anymore. So what are some of our antidotes for that? We're going to talk about that. I'm going to talk, start it off with Job 12:7, of course, because nature is really a big one. And many of us say, well, that's great, but I live in the middle of a suburb. I live in the middle of a city. What can I do? Well, sometimes if we can't partake in nature, we can. Or you might live in a climate that just doesn't seem to allow it very often. We can learn from nature. And we're lucky, just like we are unlucky, as I was talking yesterday, in our insanity of mass media shoved in all of our senses day and night without asking for it, without requesting it. It's just there. We can't stop it. And if we don't constantly hear the ever-changing landscape, we feel like we have to catch up. New York Times has a little segment, what you need to know to start your day. So in other words, here's all let me give you in a nutshell, all these things that just happened that you've got to know about before you start your day. And of course, it's coming from the New York Times. So it's not about you or your family. It's about what's happening around the world, what's happening in the globe, what's happening on media, what's happening in fashion, what's happening in health. Were you foolish enough to think that drinking coffee would ward away your cancer? Well, if you were, here's something to tell you the exact opposite. But stay tuned, because tomorrow you will have another study that says it wards off cancer. So it's the back and forth. And we've gotten to such an extreme point that there isn't suggestions anymore. We're going to throw out in the form of a fact anything we want to, any recent study that hasn't been verified or hasn't been repeated several times or is not completely accepted or isn't rejected. And we're going to throw it out there. We're going to use the word may, but our headline is going to imply that I'm giving you fact. I'm giving you fact. That's the power. The headline implies a fact. You take the bait, you bite on the hook, you log on, and what you end up getting is a lot of suggestions, a lot of, well, there was a study that showed that perhaps kind of this may be the, even in the medical world, the medical journals, I'm finding that a lot too. It's like, here's the headline. Okay, now I've got a definitive that would help people. Here we are. Or no, what I was doing was wrong. And then you open up and you realize that there was a study that came out of some journal that suggested that. And then they give you the suggestion. And then you find, then they, which is a reasonable way to do things. This is kind of what you're supposed to do in medicine. Here are some of the deficits to the study. Well, they only studied 5 people instead of 500,000 people. So the conclusions we draw may not be valid. Or, which is really a tough one, we have people who are, let's say, they're all eating grapes. And we have this great outcome about their diabetes because they're eating grapes. So grapes cure diabetes. Now, don't take that sentence because they don't. All right. In fact, you don't want to overload on your fruits. I just made that up. So, but you'll see that. And then you realize that, and that's the study. So the study is, we need more research about this. This is great. This is awesome. But then you also realize in the study that they caused people to have a better, healthier diet. They told them to cut out the junk food. They told them to walk 5 times a day. They told them to interchange with other people, to put down their cell phones, get up and move around every 10 minutes. So when you really come down to it, in scientific world, they never factored in for the variables. And you must factor in for the variables. That's part of the scientific method. So then you have to sit back and say, well, what is it really that I'm actually looking at? Which one really helped? And you're back to square one. So we're going to jump over square one and get into it. On the other side of the break, I am Dr. Michelle. See you on the other side of the break.
You're listening to Breadbox Media. Find out more at breadboxmedia.com.
You're listening to Dr. Michelle Live. Dr. Michelle is a Catholic psychiatrist. However, the views and opinions presented by Dr. Michelle are by no means medical advice. Please consult your doctor for official medical guidance.
Well, welcome back. I am Dr. Michelle, and you are with me on this journey. We're walking it together. 573-4-BREAD-4, 573-4-BREAD-4, you can call or text. You can also email me anytime, dmlive@breadboxmedia.com. You can log on, breadboxmedia.podbean.com, and find podcasts that go back for a couple years now. So it's mind-boggling when we started Breadbox Media. And before that, we were still part of Real Life Radio, which we are no longer a part of. But we still have the podcast, so it's really awesome. I'm very happy about that. So we're growing and we're changing, and it's just wonderful. And you can be a friend of the show. This is the new thing, being a friend of the show. And it helps support the show, and it is great. So if you want to log on to breadboxmedia.com, and go to friend of the show. I think the tab is on the top now. Friend of the show, click on, go down, scroll down, find Dr. Michelle, and there you go. So we've got so many new cool things. The iTunes, you can get it through iTunes, so that's great too. It's just, it's amazing thing. We can have a world like anything of great tools, great assistance, and we can also use those things for not such good endeavors, of which I will talk to you about right now. So Job 12:7, it's Job 12:7 verses, I'm sorry, through 10. So it's chapter 12, verses 7 through 10. And I found this 7 years ago, as I was introduced to a thing called animal medicine. And animal medicine is just kind of a big old generic term. It's being used by, you know, it can be used by all kinds of people, a little sometimes from the biggest charlatan down to what it was really originally intended for. But if you really look and glean and you see these ancient civilizations, or even in many of the, I think almost all of the Native American, what's the right word, philosophies, or integral part of their life was they're tied to nature. And they looked at, they could see it as medicine. And because they were so tied to nature, they learned from the animals. They didn't just put upon the animals. We are so, we pervert so much with our affluence. And it just, we become runaway trains. We do the weirdest things. Because we don't have the balanced appreciation for the world we live in, whether it is air conditioning. I mean, there are people who just feel like, or having your cell phone, that it's more important for everyone to have cell phone than for everyone to have food. You can go right now. It doesn't matter where you are, who you are. If you have no money, you are entitled in our country to a cell phone. And not just a cell phone for danger or communication limited, but for anything you want. Get online, do whatever. All you have to do is sign up. But that before food. And there are programs, of course, for people to have food. But we see, we was there yesterday, volunteer to feed homeless people. That's where they get their food, from people who give food. So it's great, wonderful, big chain grocery stores, even very expensive health food stores, restaurants, who will donate the food. And then people donate their time and they have these beautiful meals. So let's reverse that a little bit. Let's take, and even if we have to do it in our minds, even if we have to do it in a virtual way, let's do it, because they're there for us. So when I was looking into animal medicine, someone introduced this to me in, I think it was 2009, maybe, or 10. And I was keenly interested, but I wanted to get the real nitty gritty. I didn't want the new age version. I wanted to know what the people who really knew this, because they walked the walk, what were they, what did they learn? And a lot of that in our country came from Native American tradition. And one, I was looking up an animal, because the theory and the thought is, which I find very healing and very true, is that each animal or insect, it's not like you're going to find butterflies and dolphins and unicorns and rainbows. A cockroach has its own medicine. An ant, a bee. And it was all throughout thousands and thousands and thousands of years of living with them, not because they chose to leave a life of luxury and go and live in a preserve somewhere. There was no such thing. They had no choice. They had no window screens. They didn't have screens. They didn't have air conditioning. They didn't have filters. They didn't have solar power. Their solar power was solar power. It was from the sun. They woke up with the dawn. They went to sleep. Dirt floors and branches for shelter, or wood, which invited animals, no petroleum products to ward off animals, no huge people in spray with spray cans and big masks getting rid of the ants and the snails. They had to find a way to survive with destructive bugs, with killing bugs, bugs that would actually kill you. Black widow spiders, venomous snakes, bears, hungry bears, places to put their own cubs, and you happen to wander by and they kill you to save their own cub. You had to learn how to do this. You and I have no clue. So I was introduced, I'm looking up these, whatever it was I looking up at the time, and I found Job 12:7. Someone had put that. I didn't just find it. Job is a huge book, and I'm not inclined to read it, because I just associate that with just, you know, they're just, how down can you get? You know, how many things can happen to this poor man? So, and it's huge. And so I don't, you know, I just don't, it's not something I was just inclined to pick up and start thinking there would be a nugget in there. Of course there's a nugget, but someone else found it. I didn't, this particular nugget. So there's many nuggets and everything in the Bible. I'm finding out as I just open up and wonder, why is that interesting to me? And then I realize, no, that's the word. It's the living word. It is interesting to me. And it sure enough usually is. So back to Job 12:7. It says, "But ask the animals and they will teach you, or the birds in the sky and they will tell you, or speak to the earth and it will teach you, or let the fish in the sea inform you. Which of these does not know that the hand of the Lord has done this? In his hand is the life of every creature and the breath of all mankind." So earmark it, because I kind of stumbled on those words, but it is a very beautiful, beautiful passage in the huge book of Job. It's a very small passage, but it's beautiful, and it teaches you, it tells you, God is telling Job, look, you've looked everywhere. You've asked your friends, you ask me, you ask the sky, and every time you turn around, there's pestilence, there's boils, there are people, you know, you're losing your family, your wife has decided you are making a pact with the devil, because if you weren't, you wouldn't have all these terrible things happening to you. Everything's gotten burned. You've got nothing. And then he commands him. He doesn't say, look at this place and how awesome I am. I am the God. He does say, I am God there. Which of these creatures doesn't know? But he says, ask the animals. They will teach you. They're going to teach you. The birds of the sky are going to tell you. Now you talk to the earth and the earth will teach you. Let the fish in the sea inform you. So he's actually telling him, stop what we're doing here and go talk to them, because they're going to let you know how you're supposed to live. And we have more gentle thoughts as time goes on with the lilies of the field and those passages as well. So let's take a little look at ancient history. And I'm going to get this, read this to you from the book called The Day of Piglet by Benjamin Hoff. Now, he is the one who wrote The Tao of Pooh, and he takes the Winnie the Pooh series and each character, and he looks at how they have kind of a Eastern flavor to them, mainly in the Zen tradition. But I still find this an amazingly lovely dissertation. I love what he does with it all. He takes our modern life and kind of looks at it through the eyes of narrated by the Winnie the Pooh series, and then he takes wisdom from the ancients and filters it in. So he's talking now, it's on page 132, and the title of the chapter is, if I can get it, it's Things as They Might Be. So we'll try to get this in, and I will, let's see. All right. So he's talking, he says, the fearful fantasies we have inherited condition us to believe that we need to be protected from the natural world, better living through heavy industry, and so on. In reality, as anyone ought to be able to see by now, the natural world needs to be protected from us. Its wisdom needs to be recognized, respected, and understood by us, and not merely viewed through the distorted lenses of our illusions about it. I'm going to stop right there. We're going to catch the rest on the other side of the break, but I want to make a point. Sometimes, rather tongue-in-cheek, I'll talk about putting our dogs in tutus and having them have little weddings and birthday parties and all that. It's fun, and I don't begrudge anyone doing that. And a lot of people derive an immense amount of pleasure and joy out of that. Many elderly people find their care and sustenance from caretaking these little animals and have them caretake them. But I want to put a little spin on that when we get back from the other side of the break, and also look at what we are to learn from nature. I am Dr. Michelle. You're listening to Dr. Michelle Live.
You're listening to Breadbox Media. Find out more at breadboxmedia.com.
You're listening to Dr. Michelle Live. Dr. Michelle is a Catholic psychiatrist. However, the views and opinions presented by Dr. Michelle are by no means medical advice. Please consult your doctor for official medical guidance.
welcome. I am Dr. Michelle, and you are listening to Dr. Michelle Live, and I am Dr. Michelle, so you are here right with me on Dr. Michelle Live. We are walking this path together, and it would be great to get out and walk today on this path because we would travel down a natural path. We would have red dirt beneath our feet. We would have scraggly, craggly rocks that weren't churned out from a factory on the side. We would have little plants growing up, and we would look at the little tiny, delicate blue, pure, gorgeous, brilliant, iridescent blue, tiny, tiny, tiny pin dot flowers that were growing up in between the rocks. We would look over and see the rust-colored leaves that were coming off of certain plants, and little white blossoms and weeds and old dead stumps that are artistically just strewn about with their kind of sun-bleached roots. We would see all that, and we would just look and ponder. And then in there, we would say, well, this is just a desert landscape, or this is a place that no one lives. And then you would look closer, and you would see that life is brilliantly abundant everywhere. I learned that in the desert. I never wanted to be in the desert. I did not want to be in the desert. God evidently thought otherwise. I went to school in Flagstaff, Arizona. I loved the mountains, and I'd have to drive through the Mojave Desert from California to get there. I would have to go into the desert to get to any other city off that mountaintop. And I just thought, what is the desert? It's beautiful at dawn when you're driving through, and at sunset when you're driving back. But other than that, there's nothing here. And then I lived there for on and off for 3 years, and I saw life like I couldn't believe. I saw and witnessed and was a part of more life in that desert than I am on a day-to-day basis here in beautiful, teeming with life, Southern California. Everywhere. And if you just look and you learn something just looking out my window, I will always miss that place, and I hope I never forget it. Just sitting at this crummy little table I found for free on the side of the road with a little sign that says free. I thought, okay, sure. And some guy, this is so great, some guy walking two little dogs with a Christopher medal around his neck said, can I help you load that in your car? And he did. And so I thought, oh, this is great. I need this table. I love that table. I don't have that table now. It's somewhere in Arizona. But sitting there looking out those kind of, the house was a disaster house. However, it sat atop this little hill, and looking out that French door and seeing what was going to be my mystery today. I could have a rattlesnake sitting right there, or a 5 foot long snake. I would not know what kind of snake it was, or a brilliantly black, white giant, snake, I forgot the name now all of a sudden, a bull snake sitting out strewn across, or I could see thousands of little finches only for a few minutes in the morning before other animals woke up, weighing down the weeds that had grown up that day, because there happened to be one rain in the desert, and boom, all of a sudden the earth took advantage of the water and sprouted these things you couldn't believe. Then you would find the rabbits coming up, and then the family after family after family of quail, and the cardinal mating and courting its female cardinal. And then when the babies came teaching on my little fence post, teaching the ones to fly from the fence post to the top of the roof and back, and how they fed each other, and how they each little subgroup looked out for each other, and how they warned each other. And then when the hawk would swoop down, or the roadrunner would run by, and then a coyote one time opened up, and there's a coyote sitting right on my doorstep. Another time opened up the door, going out with my coffee, and there was a coiled up rattlesnake. I mean, it just, and you know, you just, at one time looking out where there was nothing, it was after the winter, and there was nothing, there were no weeds and no nothing. And looking down at the barren ground that was, you wouldn't even call it a yard. It was just where I lived. And I started seeing these little teeny sticks move. And I'm thinking, why is my earth moving? Is it really moving, or am I, something's going on with me? And I look closer, and I sat there an hour and I saw these little tiny dried leaves moving just weirdly around the yard. And finally, I got way down and looked in the dirt. Yes, Dr. Michelle's doing this. Down in the dirt, and I'm watching these worms. Worms, little tiny worms coming up from their little holes. And I saw, you know, like little dry leaves bobbing. So I took one of the leaves off, and this worm was like coming up out of its hole. And then I watched it, and I had actually, unbeknownst to me, removed the top of its little shelter. And so I watched a worm, a small worm without eyes, apparently, or whatever it has instead of eyes. I learned that once in biology, and I have no longer have a recall of that. And I saw him taking his little worm body and kind of like you would with your index finger, feeling around the outside of the hole until he found just the right piece of debris, plant debris, and he dragged it over to the hole, and he would set it up in such a way that I'm watching this for over an hour and a half. Really, I was. And I was watching him put this scaffolding. And when he would put a little stick, or she or it, because I think they are both, I don't remember now, put the little stick across, if it wasn't just quite right, he would take his little worm body and nudge it until it got just the right angle. And then he would find another one the same way, just kind of feeling around, find another one, bring it over. It was the white, right weight. And I watched him even discard different options. And then he would build the scaffolding. And then when it was time, he did his little feeling around number again and found just the right part of a leaf and put it on top. And then I realized that there were hundreds, probably thousands, exactly like that. And there they were, desert worms, sure to be some, you know, they have no protection in the world. So they have no protection. They are vulnerable. We talked about vulnerability yesterday. They are vulnerable to everything. In the desert, when you have no plant protection, you have no cover of leaves and foliage and grass and plants and flowers and big trees and lusciousness. You're out there and you're all have just the meager subsistence. You have to find different ways to protect yourself so that you can have your life. And so what happened? Well, every finch, every hawk, every snake, everything is going to want that worm. They're going to want the worm. So the worm can't just be hanging out and obvious because there is nothing to hide. So they had to find their own way. Now, how can we take that example for our own lives? I can think of so many ways right now, just telling you that story, how I need to learn that lesson in my own life right now, 2016, busy Southern California, busy leaf blowing situation out here, lots of airplanes to ride, lots of things to do, lots of concerns, lots of worries. And I can think right there, that was that worm from back then is a ever living lesson to me. So let's see what Benjamin Hoff is quoting for us today. So before the break, we were talking about how we have these fearful fantasies. I love the way he says that. He's a great writer. The fearful fantasies we have inherited have conditioned us to believe that we need to be protected from the natural world. What are the fearful fantasies? I'm going to add. He gives us an example with capital letters because this was a slogan, better living through heavy industry. We will live better if we create heavy industry, and if it will give us, what do we hear all the time? It'll make more jobs. It'll help protect you. You are vulnerable. You need that protection. You need something big. You need that steel machine. You need those screens. You need to have no windows and a big machine blowing air through your living space. I mean, really? Why do we need that? I want it. I paid for it. I actually had somebody come in and install one after 100 degree weather. But part of that is because where I'm living is constructed must have that. It wasn't constructed with nature in mind. But now we can't live without them, just like I was saying with the cell phone. People did do that before we had them, you know. So in reality, anyone ought to be able to see by now the natural world needs protection from us. Its wisdom needs to be recognized, respected, and understood, not merely viewed through the distorted lens of our illusion about it. As Sir Arthur Conan Doyle cautioned through his character Sherlock Holmes, quote, "One's ideas must be as broad as nature if they are to interpret nature," unquote. Oh, I love that. And when one, that's why these people are like, they're not me. This is why they are icons, because they were instruments of the voice of God flowing through them to do some swirly God thing in their head, to have just their regular everyday sketchy life come out with the stuff that is here to teach us forever. So that's why I want to caution you before the break. We love to tear down our heroes and our idols. We love to talk about all the dirty underside of some of our founding fathers or some of the great writers or some of the wisdom makers. We like to take, like David, man, if you wanted to just switch that, King David, and look at all the sketchy and awful things he did, And we now would use that as a reason not to believe him. Well, look at him. He's a hypocrite. He's awful. He's horrible. No, he became the instrument of God. He probably always was the instrument of God. He just was completely lost until he was found. So we're going to find a little bit more about nature and how that can help you on your road when we return. Have a nice drink of water. In the meantime, we'll see you on the other side of the break.
You're listening to Breadbox Media. Find out more at breadboxmedia.com.
You're listening to Dr. Michelle Live. Dr. Michelle is a Catholic psychiatrist. However, the views and opinions presented by Dr. Michelle are by no means medical advice. Please consult your doctor for official medical guidance.
Welcome back. I am Dr. Michelle. You're with me today, walking this road of nature, life, love, harmony, together in a world of destruction and vulnerability and fear. Now, when I say those things, I mean, listen to your body. When I speak the words of beauty, wonder, nature, love, happiness, I feel better. I feel lighter. And when I speak the words destruction and fear and vulnerability, I get something occurs. It's like my body is listening to me. My ears are hearing the words I'm saying, because they do, right? You do not take away the words. You listen to your words. You can't help it. You hear your words. So when you hear your own words, you are making the word flesh, and your flesh is going, she said fear, she said vulnerable. Oh, and it starts to feel it. And then it starts to search. Okay, what am I fearful of? What am I vulnerable of? And then it comes up with all the reasons that that same body, why it's reacting that way, why that same body would even say those words. They wouldn't, this body would not say the word and react if there wasn't a meaning behind the word. So, and, you know, interestingly, we find that people who are disconnected for whatever reason, perhaps a quirk of nature, a huge injury, a stroke, insult, whatever, who actually speak words but that have no meaning, or speak words we might know as actual words, but yet they're not in a context pertinent to the speaker, they don't have the same reactions because there's no meaning there. So we're way cooler than we seem to understand on a day-to-day level. So let's get back to simplicity so I don't go off into orbit. So as we go on, quoting now from Benjamin Hoff, The Day of Piglet, that's his book. We were looking at Sherlock Holmes and what Sherlock Holmes said, as quoted by Benjamin Hoff. Sherlock Holmes said, one's ideas must be as broad as nature if they are to interpret nature. And when one tries to rise above nature, one is liable to fall below it. Chung Tse's words to that effect have a timely ring. Now, Chung Tse is who Benjamin Hoff is now quoting. When, and this is ancient wisdom now, when leaders pursue knowledge but do not follow the way, all who follow them become lost in confusion. How can I say this is so? Much knowledge is applied in the making of bows, crossbows, arrows, and slingshots, but the birds in the air are disturbed and injured by it. Much knowledge is used in making hooks, nets, and other such devices, but the fish in the waters are disturbed and injured by it. Much knowledge is utilized in the design and placement of traps, meshes, and snares, but the creatures of the ground are disturbed and injured by it. As knowledge becomes increasingly clever, versatile, and artful, the people all around are disturbed and injured by it. Now, this is Benjamin Hoff speaking again. They then struggle to grasp what they do not know, but make no attempt to grasp what they already know. They condemn the misunderstanding of others, but do not condemn their own. From this, more confusion comes. If the sun and moon lost their light, the mountains and rivers abandoned their vitality. You know what? I'm sorry. This is still Chung Tse. This is still ancient knowledge. So let me go back when I said it was Benjamin Hoff. As knowledge becomes increasingly clever, versatile, and artful, the people all around are disturbed and injured by it. They then struggle to grasp what they do not know, but make no attempt to grasp what they already know. They condemn the misunderstanding of others, but do not condemn their own. From this, more confusion comes. If the sun and moon lost their light, the mountains and rivers abandoned their vitality, and the four seasons came to an end, no insect or plant would retain its true nature. Yet this is the condition produced in men by the obsession for knowledge. Honesty and simplicity are overlooked, and restlessness is admired. Quiet, effortless action is forgotten, and loud quarreling is heard. Such is the nature of hunger for knowledge. Its noise throws the world into chaos. And then Benjamin Hoff says, we might add some other words by Chung Tse. And then he goes back to quote, men honor what lies within the sphere of their knowledge, but do not realize how dependent they are on what lies beyond it. To illustrate the vital truth, this is Benjamin again, of the last statement, we have decided to give a very brief history of what we call popular radiation. In the 1930s, as people were dying from the effects of radium-laced health tonics, the U.S. government established its first maximum level of tolerable exposure to radiation, just in case you know. In the 1940s, following the study of Hiroshima bombing victims, that level was halved, just to be safe. You understand. In the 1950s, in response to concern over nuclear bomb testing fallout, which seemed to be affecting some people in unpleasant ways, the maximum tolerant level was substantially lowered, just as a precaution. At the same time, however, utility company advertisements were extolling the charms of the newest form of power generation, clean and safe nuclear energy. Their billboards invited customers to take the family to the nuclear power park. X-ray machines were being used in shoe stores to examine children's feet, and people were having their supposedly enlarged but actually normal thyroid glands irradiated. Like many exposed to radiation before them, a sizable number of these people developed cancer and died. In the 1960s, more and more people came to suspect that they weren't being told the whole truth about this sort of thing. And then, in the 1970s, researchers reported that Americans were being exposed to 9 times more radiation from medical applications than from the atmosphere nuclear fallout, which by then, due in part to studies of certain Nevada residents and military personnel, was being connected with all sorts of problems. In 1979, the Three Mile Island nuclear facility broke down and irradiated the surrounding area. In the 1980s, new data on the Hiroshima victims and their descendants show that the risk of cancer from radiation was up to 15 times greater than authorities had previously believed. Emissions from nuclear plants were linked with thyroid damage, miscarriages, and other health problems. And before the end of the decade, the Chernobyl nuclear facility, like Three Mile Island before it, had done what experts in the field had said it would do in 1,000 years. Reports of near disasters at other plants were being leaked to the press, so the, quote, safe exposure, unquote, level was lowered again, not taking any chances. At each step of the way, authorities assured the public that the new devices and new amounts of radiation were safe, and each time, they were wrong. Today, the public is being captivated by computers, word processors, and the like, whose cathode rays tubes emit X-ray radiation and whose circuits and display terminals produce strong electromagnetic fields. They're perfectly safe, authorities assure us, and if any difficulty should happen to develop, we will certainly be notified later on. The latest popular radiation device is the microwave oven, which bombards food with high-frequency electromagnetic radiation, irritating it until it heats up. This sort of perversion of nature is perfectly safe, authorities insist. If it weren't, the wonderful machines wouldn't be on the market. Maybe the authorities are correct this time for just once. On the other hand, maybe they're not. And then he goes on to quote Christopher Robin. As soon as he had finished his lunch, Christopher Robin whispered to Rabbit, and Rabbit said, "Yes, of course," and they walked a little way up a stream together. "I didn't want the others to hear," Christopher Robin said. "Quite so," said Rabbit. It's only Rabbit. "I suppose you don't know, but what does the North Pole look like?" "Well," said Rabbit, stroking his whiskers, "now you're asking me." "I did know once, only I've sort of forgotten," Christopher Robin carelessly said. "It's a funny thing," said Rabbit, "but I've sort of forgotten, too, although I did know once. I suppose it's just a pole stuck in the ground?" "Sure to be a pole," said Rabbit, "because of calling it a pole. And if it is a pole, well, I should think it would be sticking out of the ground, shouldn't you? Because there would be nowhere else to stick it." "Yes, that's what I thought." "The only thing," said Rabbit, "is where is it sticking?" "That's what we're looking for," said Christopher Rabbit. "Say," said Piglet, "look at that window." "It's the Huffalump," cried Piglet, jumping up and down. "Oh, it's the garbage man taking away the recycling. You didn't really think it was a Huffalump, did you?" "No, no, not really," said Piglet. "And if it had been a Huffalump, what could he have done to you?" "I don't know," said Piglet, "but he might have done something." "You don't know what a Huffalump is, do you?" "Well, not exactly. You don't even know if it exists, do you?" "Well, do they?" "Not in this part of the world, anyway." "Are you sure?" "Absolutely." "You won't find a Huffalump around here anymore. Then you'll more than you'll find a giraffe putting up a sign at your house." "Oh," said Piglet, "I see." So the whole point of this is that how we start making up these little fantasy rules and then we believe them, then they became, this is me speaking actually, not Benjamin or Piglet or the ancient warrior. We begin believing the thing before it because we lose the original meaning. So get back to the basics. That's what we're going to be talking about. That's what we want to do. Get back to simplicity. Get back to yourself. Take a look at Job 12:7. Ground yourself back in God and nature. Be simple. Breathe in the air. Drink the water. And I will see you tomorrow. This is Dr. Michelle.
You're listening to Breadbox Media. Find out more at breadboxmedia.com.